So it is November 19th, 2009 in Radadesh. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 25, The Characteristics of King Puranjana. Text 15. Nilaspatika Vaidurya Muktamara Katarunai Kliptaharmyastalim Diptam Shriya Bhogavati Miva. So we're continuing here with Narada Muni is talking to King Puranjana, and he's describing the body as if it were a city. So now he's describing the capital of the kingdom practically, actually. And he's describing now the capital. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The floors of the houses in that city were made of sapphire, crystal, diamonds, pearls, emeralds, and rubies. Because of the luster of the houses in the capital, the city was compared to the celestial town named Bhogavati. Purport. In the city of the body, the heart is considered to be the capital. Just as the capital of a state is especially gorgeously filled with various high buildings and lustrous palaces, the heart of the body is filled with various desires and plans for material enjoyment. Such plans are sometimes compared to valuable jewels, such as sapphires, rubies, pearls, and emeralds. The heart becomes the center for all planning for material enjoyment. Nilaspatika vaidurya muktamara katarunai kliptaharmyam stalim diptam shriya bhagavatim miva. The floors of the houses in that city were made of sapphire, crystal, diamonds, pearls, emeralds, and rubies. Because of the luster of the houses in the capital, the city was compared to the celestial town named Bhogavati. So I don't think in the modern world we'll find any building that has floors made of diamonds and emeralds and rubies. In our temple in Detroit, which used to be the Fisher Mansion, and the floors do have gold in them. The floors are made of tiles that have indentations, and the indentations are filled with 24 karat gold. But what happens as you walk on the floors, the gold gets worn away. So most of the floors, you see the gold just on the periphery of the floors and not in the middle places. So generally people don't put the most valuable things in the floor because that gets worn down. But we don't see very many. I mean, this is a particularly nice place. Is that real gold leaf on the moldings? Is that actual gold leaf? Yeah. So that's very thin. If any of you have ever worked with gold leaf, it's extremely, extremely thin. If you've ever seen like tissue paper, very, 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 very thin. And if you just touch it a little, it breaks. I did a lot of the gold leafing at Prabhupada's palace in New Vrindavan. And, you know, it's real gold, but it's extremely thin. You can practically take it off with your fingernail. And I was just recently at the summer palace of the Tsars in St. Petersburg, Russia. And there also, it's all gold leaf. It's not solid gold. And I asked them, I said, what's the gold leaf over? Do you know under this gold leaf, is this plaster or wood? No. So they said in the summer palace a lot of it was wood, because often what they do is they just do cheap plaster moldings and then they just cover that with gold leaf. But I had a real treat in St. Petersburg. Any of you familiar with the Amber Room? Have you heard of the Amber Room? So in the days of the Russian Tsars, do you all know what amber is? So it's a sap of a tree that's become fossilized, the sap of pine trees. Just like we burn frankincense is the sap of pine trees, although most frankincense just comes from Oman. And it's very interesting, the frankincense trees in Oman grow right out of the rock. And they get practically no water and practically no earth minerals, and it's always windy there, and it practically never rains there, and still you get these frankincense trees going right out of the rock and producing the frankincense that we burn. So when that resin becomes fossilized, it's called amber. And if you've ever seen amber, it's usually kind of a golden color. And it can range anywhere from yellow to red. So they designed this room in the days of the Russian czars, where all of the walls were solid amber. Now, you don't get you can't get a sheet of amber like you can get a sheet of marble. You can't get a sheet of amber. So it's little pieces of amber made into a mosaic. You all know what a mosaic is? You take little tiles and you make a picture out of them. But these are natural amber, and they've been put together to form various pictures all over the walls and all over the ceiling. So during World War II, when the Nazis tried to conquer Russia unsuccessfully, one of the things they did do was they took all the amber out of the amber room. And they supposedly packed it up. The rumor has it that they packed it up with photographs so that they could recreate it in Germany. But then somehow during the course of the war, it was the boxes with all the amber were lost. Nobody knows. It's one of the mysteries, what happened to the amber from the amber room. It's never been recovered. But recently, in the last 20 years, the Russian government recreated that room with new amber. So you go there, but even then, they don't put it on the floor. They're putting it in the walls and the ceiling, but not the floor. And it's such a beautiful room when you have the lights, especially if you had candles. It's reflecting off the walls and bouncing off each other, and the whole room looks like it's glowing. So it was interesting, because I had read about this when I used to teach history in secondary school, and I thought, boy, it'd be nice to see that, but it's gone. Nobody can see it anymore. It doesn't exist anymore. But recently, when I was in St. Petersburg, my friend said, how would you like to go for a walk? I said, sure, let's go for a walk. So then they ended up taking me to the Summer Palace, and there was the Amber Room. But we don't see this sort of thing very often. It's not very common that somebody sees a room made of jewels. And, of course, amber is considered semi-precious. I don't know if there's any room in the world today that's covered with, you know, sapphires, diamonds, emeralds, rubies. That would be very, very unusual for anyone to have that amount of wealth. If someone has even just one ruby or one emerald or one diamond that's of good quality, that's very unusual. And nobody would think to put these precious gems in the floor. So we would all like, I'm sure, to live in a place like this. That was so beautiful. This is the soul is actually hankering for beauty. And it's described that there are places like this on the higher planets, the celestial town named Bhogavati. So the Vedas teach us that there's life on other planets, there's residents of other planets. They have bodies more subtle than we have. They have many times more enjoyment than we have. So they have places like this, that everything's made of jewels, even the floors. What to speak of course, in the transcendental spiritual world, Chintamani Prakarasadmasu Kalpaviksha Lakshabhateshu Surabhirabhi Palayantam. So there, Chintamani, money means a pearl or a jewel, and Chinta means conscious. So not only do they have, is everything made of jewels, but the jewels are alive. And sometimes novelists imagine such things. The famous Christian writer, C.S. Lewis, he imagined that there was a world where jewels were alive. He wrote about that, what was it? I think The Silver Chair, where you could go to some deeper world where you could find living rubies and living diamonds, and that you could eat them. They were like fruits. And you could get, you know, ruby juice and sapphire juice. But actually there's a place where there's living jewels in the spiritual world. So the heart of the living entity is here compared to such a place. It's here compared to a place like the Amber Room, but much nicer than that. Not just amber, but jewels and sapphires and crystals and rubies. And it's interesting that comparison is made here even for material desires. I mean, we might think that spiritual desires would be described that way, but here material desires are described that way. So how one wants to enjoy. So, of course, there's not really an explanation given anywhere as to why this analogy is made. Why are the material desires in the heart of the living being compared to a room that even the floors, you know, we can imagine that if the floors are like that, that the rest of the room must be like that too. I'm sure the walls and the ceilings were also filled with precious jewels and precious metals. So the nature, we can think a little bit about the nature of desires and about the nature of the heart. Because as I said, wouldn't you all like to live in a place like that? And it's full of jewels and beauty. A place that's full of beauty. Everybody wants to be in a beautiful place. People spend a lot of money to create their own home as a beautiful place, isn't it? If people have enough money, they hire an interior decorator. You ever been in a house that was done by a professional decorator? My father had a house like that. Actually, had two houses like that. And when you went into the house, you felt like you were walking into a painting. Felt like the whole house, you know, was a painting. So people want to have their homes like that, or gardens like that. And that's one of the reasons that people come here for tours. So many people come here because they're thinking, let me see something beautiful. Let me see beautiful gardens. Let me see some beautiful castle, isn't it? And people would love to live in a place like that. Or they're traveling, just like my kids live in Hawaii. So many people travel to Hawaii just because they want to see beauty. And it was interesting when I left Hawaii to go to New Zealand. So I was talking to the people in line at the airport. I said, "Why are you going to New Zealand?" And they said, "We've heard it's very beautiful there." And I said, "You're already in Hawaii. You're not going to get better than this." But that's the desire, you know, to go to some place that's beautiful, to live in some place that's beautiful. Now, ultimately, where we live is the heart. And that's the residence of the living entity. Sometimes it's called the sitting place of the living entity. So what is this place that we're living in? So the nature of material desires basically means that I want to have some enjoyment that's separate from Krishna. I want to have some enjoyment that's in illusion. Something like a child who doesn't want to eat dinner with the family, but instead wants to go in their room and make food out of clay. Or somebody who, it's a beautiful day, the sun's shining, their friends are going for a picnic, and they want to stay in a dark room and take intoxication. So material desires are something like that. That you're looking for pleasure in a way separate from the reservoir of all pleasure. You're trying to grab your pleasure in a separate, independent way. So the basis for material desires, the basic things that people want materially, are things like happiness and freedom, power, opulence, which are all the natural attributes of the soul. But they're looking for them in the wrong way. But even so, these desires are said here to be effulgent and beautiful and colorful. Even the material desires. So just imagine how beautiful and colorful the spiritual desires are. So how do we get from the material desires to the spiritual desires? Spiritual desires basically means that I want all these things in a way where I'll actually get them. It's really just that simple. Another analogy you could say, material desires would be like looking for milk in an automobile shop. You're just not likely to find it there. So how do we get from material to spiritual desires? Because only if we go to spiritual desires we really live in a beautiful place. The material, if we have our home decorated with material desires, then we may have some illusion of beauty, but we don't have the real thing. It's not actually enjoyable. There's a nice story of this in the Greek, I don't know how true it is, what they call Greek mythology, of the Odyssey. You all studied the Odyssey in school? Or do they not teach such things anymore? Okay. So in the Odyssey, the hero, Ulysses, he's just come back from winning the Trojan War, and he's on his ship. Prabhupada sometimes refers to parts of this story in his classes also. Anyway, so Ulysses is coming on the ship, and he's warned that there's an island of witches that he's going to pass, and these witches sing songs. And if you hear the songs, you'll go to the island and you'll be devoured. That he was told, make sure everyone puts wax in their ears. So as they went past this island, he told his men, now you all put wax in your ears, but I want to hear what is this sound that can enchant somebody. So he asked his men to tie him to the mast of the ship. And he says, any command that I give while we go past this island, don't obey it. wait till we go past the island. So because Ulysses was hearing the singing of the witches when he saw the island, he saw it as these beautiful young women on an island with palm trees and coconuts and mangoes and all these things and beautiful rivers. But the men who had the wax in their ears, they just saw witches on a desert island with piles of human bones. Right? So they were rowing very, very fast to get past. And it's called, the witches are called the sirens, which is where we get our word siren, meaning a warning. So material desires are like that. We think, oh, this is something nice, and actually it's not nice. We're thinking this is going to give me what I want. I'm thinking my fear, my anger, my lust, my envy, my greed, they'll give me what I want. They'll give me protection, they'll give me enjoyment, they'll give me freedom, they'll give me autonomy, and they actually give exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. But there's some glitter. There's some hope, some glitter, like some jewels glittering in the light. And we think, yes, I will arrange everything in this world so that I will have all this enjoyment. And you know, it just doesn't happen. It really doesn't happen. Maybe it happens for a moment where you think, oh, now I have what I want. And then again, it disappoints you. But spiritual desires are the real form of desires of the soul. We are not meant to be without desires. The Buddhists and the impersonalists, they say, then you just simply have no desires. So we don't say, no, I have no desires. We say desires are a part of the soul. And this desire to be surrounded by beauty and opulence and harmony, this is because we come from such a place. It's natural. Every being is naturally wants to be in the environment for which it is suited. So how do we get from these material desires to spiritual desires? It's really just a question of cleaning them. And Prabhupada talks about how really all it is that we're covered with a layer of dirt, or we're covered with the modes of material nature. Karna guna sangasya. The causes that we've associated with the material modes of nature. And, you know, if you have very beautiful jewels, even if they're dirty, they may still be attractive. They may still have some attractiveness, so you can't appreciate the real beauty. Like my mother gave me this gold necklace that I wear. So a little while ago, when I was in America, we were out shopping, and I said, let's go get it cleaned. I went to a jewelry shop. I said, do you have a cleaning machine? And they just put it in the machine. And my daughter put her gold bracelets in. And we come out, and she said, wow, I didn't know how dirty they were. You know, even dirty gold and dirty jewels are still attractive. And you may not even realize how dirty they are. So our material desires, still they attract us, because they're ultimately spiritual desires that are covered. So what we want to do is take out the covering. We want to take off the dirt, bring them back to their original form, and then they'll actually satisfy us. I was just listening this morning, Prabhupada talking about Dhruva Maharaj, how Dhruva Maharaj wanted a kingdom greater than his grandfather, and his grandfather ran the universe. So that's pretty hard. How do you get a kingdom greater than the universe? Actually, he wanted vengeance. That's very typical, that if somebody hurts us or insults us, that we want them hurt back. Or we want to show, just see how much better I am than you. You know, how dare you insult me? Actually, just see what I've accomplished. See my victories. So Dhruva had this desire. His stepmother had insulted him. His father had insulted him. He wanted to see how I'm better than you. But when he actually contacted the Lord, Prabhupada said he felt all of his desires fulfilled. It's not explained that when he saw the Lord, that he didn't have any more desires. That wasn't the case. What the case was, he was fulfilled. Prabhupada said, like when you eat a meal, then if someone comes to give you more, you say, no, thank you. So one's desires are fulfilled in their natural state, not in their unnatural state. To want our desires fulfilled is not wrong. That's our natural state. But to fulfill them in illusion, that is wrong. So how do we clean the heart? I was thinking about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu with the cleaning of the Gundicha temple, which is compared to cleaning the heart. And this temple is not used during the year. It's only used for, 10 days or 2 weeks when Lord Jagannath goes there during 9 days. When Lord Jagannath goes there during the Rath Yatra. So Jagannath goes from the main temple to the Gundicha temple, stays there for 9 days, and then goes back. And the rest of the year, that temple's not used. So you can imagine it gets very dirty. It's any place that's not used for 11, 12 months out of the year. And especially in India, things get really dirty. Things get really dusty. Remember when I was staying in India, we basically had to wash everything in the house at least twice a day. Otherwise, it was all gritty. So in the Gundicha temple, there's all this dust and grit and stones and twigs and leaves and so many things. And the devotees are, first they're sweeping. Right? You sweep, you get the gross dust. And then they're taking water pots and they're pouring, they're actually like pouring water pots on the wall. You know, they're pouring it on the ceiling and pouring it on the wall, and it's flowing down, and then they're sweeping it out the door. And not only do they sweep it out the door, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also cleaned the area outside the temple so that no dust would come back in. You know, have you ever done that? You just like take the dust just right outside your door and then it just comes back in. Sometimes it's like that with spiritual life. You think, okay, now I've gotten rid of this thing, and then it pops back up the next day, you know, because all you did was push it to the other side of the door. So he cleans the outside of the temple. And then he cleaned it a second time. Then he went through and did the whole process all over again for the finer dust, right, with the broom and then the water. And then and he cleaned it with his own cloth. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took his own, you know, cloth and used that as a cleaning cloth. And then he said, now this is a place that is fit for the Lord to sit. Everything. And he said, the heart of the devotee should be just like that. With the story of Amoga. Amoga was the son-in-law of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and his wife were older, and they were what's called Kshetra Sannyasis. They were Vanaprastas, who instead of traveling, because they already lived in Jagannath Puri, they just stayed in Jagannath Puri. And Sarvabhauma was there as a teacher. And I'm not sure if he had any other children, but they had this one daughter. And the Sarvabhauma was maintaining his married daughter and her husband. So, you know, sometimes we just think, okay, it's always like this or like this. Always the girl goes off to live with the husband's family. But at least in this case, the son-in-law came. He was living with Sarvabhauma and his wife. And Prabhupada said that Sarvabhauma and his wife were maintaining Amoga. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and his wife cooked for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Lord Chaitanya came over to eat prasadam. And this... they knew that their son-in-law was very envious. Now, sometimes even our family members are not so pleasing. So they thought, we don't want Amoga to come and see us feeding Chaitanya Mahaprabhu because he'll find something to criticize. You know people like that? That no matter what you do, they find something to criticize. Even if everything's really nice, they say, look at that fault. So Sarvabhauma was actually guarding the door to make sure Amoga didn't come in. Anyway, Amoga somehow managed to come to the door, and he looks in and he says, look how much that sannyasi is eating. Now, of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was eating a lot. I mean, there was a lot of prasadam there. And so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, well, that's all right. He just spoke the truth. But the problem was his mentality. His mentality was envious and critical. Ah, look how much he's eating. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya starts running after Amoga with a stick. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, ah, it's okay, just leave him. And after the meal, Sarvabhauma and his wife were saying, better if our son-in-law dies. You know, nobody wishes their children's spouses to die. I mean, especially in a culture where widows never remarried. You know, her husband died, she'd be alone the rest of her life. So nobody would have such a desire, but they were thinking, this man is so offensive, better that he dies. They were actually praying like that. Let our daughter become a widow. Can you imagine? Praying like that, let my daughter become a widow. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu heard about this, and he was very compassionate because he loved Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. So he went to see Amoga, and he touched his heart, and he said, you're a brahmana. Your heart is supposed to be a sitting place for Krishna. He said, why have you allowed jealousy and envy to sit in your heart also? How is Krishna going to sit there? Now, if you're going to invite me to your house for dinner, you don't want to have somebody there who's my enemy also. That wouldn't be very pleasing. You know, I'll come to the door and I'll see, oh, here's somebody who hates me, and I'll turn around and I'll leave. So we don't want these things in our heart. And so therefore, how do we clean the heart? What do we do to clean the heart? What is the process of cleaning the heart? So we can actually live in a nice place, nicer than Bhogavati. Bhogavati is just the heavenly planets. We'd like to live in Goloka Vrindavan. And so we can invite Krishna into our heart. Krishna's already in our heart. Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hridayesha Arjuna Tisthati. But he may not be manifest there to us. Just like the yogis, they meditate on their heart. They actually see the Lord on the heart. They're talking to the Lord in the heart. Everywhere they go, they see Krishna. Premanjanatri Tabhakti Vilotanena Santa Sadaiva Hridayeshu Vilokayanti Yam Sham Sundaramachincha Gunasarupam. In their hearts, they're seeing the Lord. And he's not going to make himself visible unless it's a clean heart. He's not very impressed by, you know, dirty jewels. Jewels covered with muck. And where envy is also sitting in the heart, it's not really where he wants to go. So how do we clean the heart? It's actually not that difficult a thing to clean the heart. I basically, first of all, one has to want to clean the heart. In the second chapter of the first canto, Prabhupada writes about that one attains to the transcendental position basically just by desiring to do so. And we think, well, I desire to do so. Now, desiring to do so means you actually want to clean the heart. You ever go to somebody's house, their house is really, really dirty, and they say, well, yeah, I want to clean my house. I have one good friend like that. I'd like to clean my house. I wish I had a clean house. Well, then, why don't you clean it? You know, no, I'd rather do this or do that or the other thing. So desiring means action. Desiring doesn't just mean dreaming, like the guy lying on the couch and drinking beer and saying, yeah, I'd like to go to medical school. That we don't mean desiring like that. That's not really desiring. Dhridavrita. A firm determination. I was also just reading about Rukmini. I see she read a Gopi now. Rukmini wants to be Krishna's wife. And she writes a letter and she says, my dear Lord, I will do austerities for the rest of my life if you will not accept me. And if that's not sufficient, then I'm prepared to do austerities lifetime after lifetime after lifetime until you will accept me. And Prabhupada says, that determination is the only price for attaining Krishna's favor. I want to clean my heart. Prabhupada writes, if you just want things to remain as it is, then what can be done? You know, if you think, yes, see my dirty jewels, how nice they are. Yes, they're all covered with mud and gunk and pig poop, but you know, they're my nice diamonds and crystals. So you have to want to clean the heart. Wanting to clean the heart means that one has to face oneself. Cheta darpana marjanam. You have to be willing to look in the mirror. And this is also called humility. To really, because we tend to think, yes, all my desires are very nice. All my plans are very nice. I'm a very good person. I have a very good heart. I'm very kind. And I'm a devotee. So I'm not just a nice person, I'm a spiritual person. I'm really a wonderful person. But to really look in the heart and be willing to see what's there. How can you clean a room blind? Can't. You can't clean a room. Are you going to clean a room with dark glasses on and a blindfold? How are you going to do that? The first one has to be willing to see. Therefore, Prabhupada says that one has to see the naked form of material desires. One has to see material desires for what they are. One has to see the witches, not the paradise island. One has to be willing to see the witches. Why are we not willing to see that our material desires are witches? Why don't we want to see that? Well, first of all, when you see it, then immediately you have to admit that you're a fool. Because nobody goes to make friends with cannibalistic witches. So if I've made friends with cannibalistic witches for a few billion lifetimes, then I'm a grade A number one fool. And that's a difficult thing to admit. We would rather blame God. Why has God made me so I have a tendency to fall down? Why has God put me in this situation? How could I have left the spiritual world if it was such a nice place? Maybe it wasn't really such a nice place. Must have been something wrong there. You know, he must not have given me a fair chance. I really don't want these things. They're being forced on me. I don't really want my lust and anger and envy and greed. Maya is just forcing me. I want to give them up. So in so many ways, we don't want to admit that, yeah, I'm maintaining these material desires. They're mine. I own them. I have them. So that's one reason why we don't want to look, how we don't want to see the truth. Tatvadarshina, to see the truth. Another reason we don't want to see the naked form of our material desires is that we've become attached to them. You know, we still have some hope that my lust, my anger, my envy, my greed will get me what I want, even though all the evidence points to the contrary. You know, even though all our anger has ever done is hurt us, it hasn't protected us, it hasn't kept us safe, it hasn't kept us intelligent. All our lust has done is cause us pain. It hasn't given us any pleasure. All our envy has done is cause us anxiety. It hasn't really pushed us to get the things that we want. But we're attached to them. And just like people become attached to some pet that kills them. You ever read about this in the newspaper? Somebody's pet kills them? You know, people keep all these odd pets like tigers or... Do they do that in this country? Some people who do that in America, at least. Maybe the people in Belgium are smarter, but... There are people in America who keep... And many times it's illegal. The government usually has laws against keeping these pets, so sometimes they hide their pets from the government. They keep their alligator or their tiger, python, yeah, tarantulas. Once met someone who kept tarantulas. Oh, they're very friendly. I'm like, okay, fine, you know. Oh, there was a big news thing many years ago in America about these guys who work with tigers on a stage. They were performing act with tigers, and in the middle of a performance, one of the tigers attacked one of the performers. It was like headline news for a while. So, but the person is thinking, oh, these are my tigers. They're my pets. They're my friends. So we become attached to our material desires. We don't realize that they're going to eat us. You know, if you're really attached to something, you often don't want to see it honestly. I mean, we really have to think, do I want to see my material desires for what they are? And when one sees the naked form of material desires, naturally, one becomes detached from them. It doesn't require any effort at all. It didn't require any effort for the men to say, I don't want to go to that island with the witches. It wasn't some sort of a struggle. And then Krishna takes them away. Vidyanta sta badrani vidyunoti sritsna. Vidyanta, also within the heart. Talking about the heart, Krishna just takes them away. So the key is, does one want to see the truth? That's really the whole key. And of course, once you see the truth, you also have to act on the truth. If you see the truth, you can decide to keep your material desires, just like Dhritarashtra. Vidura said to him, your son is a demon. He's going to destroy the family. You're too attached to your son, and this attachment to your son is going to ruin everything. You're going to lose everything. And Dhritarashtra says, you're right, but I don't care. I want to keep it anyway. I'm not going to give up my attachment, even though it's going to mean the death of my son and the ruination of everything that I have. So to want to see the truth and then to be willing to act on the truth. Be willing to say, all right, I'm going to let go of this and trust Krishna. Just trust Krishna. And when we let go of a material desire, it's often scary because you think, well, if I let go of this, what will I have? If I get rid of my tiger, who will keep me company? I'll be lonely, right? There'll be nobody to greet me with a roar when I come home from work. And what will happen to me? What will happen to me? So there has to be some faith that the spiritual desires will be superior. That with the spiritual desires, I'll actually be satisfied. Just like eating a full meal. You know, imagine if you had some plate that you hadn't washed from the previous meal and it had some old food stuck on it. And the person serving out prasadam says, you know, I'm not going to serve it out. You've got to wash the plate first. Well, I don't want to wash my plate. It's got something left on it. There's something there I can eat. So first you have to wash the plate, then you can get the... So we often think, okay, first I want to get the spiritual, then I'll give up the material. No. It doesn't work like that. You have to be willing to say, okay, I'll give up this material desire. And then immediately Krishna takes it away, and immediately one is fulfilled. So that is what we should be doing in the heart. And then the heart will be such a nice place. And then we'll be happy. As Prabhupada said, the materialists see the world as aggressive, but the devotees see everything as happily situated. Then we'll be happy even in this world. I'll be happy even in this world. Even with the miseries of the body and the mind and other living entities and nature and so many things. We'll be feeling happy. We'll be in our own beautiful home in the heart. And then Krishna will sit down there with us and we'll see him. Prabhupada said in Geneva, said, chanting Hare Krishna means you make a diamond throne in your heart. And you invite Krishna to sit on the throne, and you bathe his feet with Ganga and Jamuna water, and you dress him in nice new clothes, and you decorate him with jewels. So that is the situation once the heart is cleaned. So what are we waiting for? And this is it's a question, it's on us. Where do I want to live? Do I want to live in just this Bhogavati, or do I want to live in Goloka Vrindavan? And that depends on us and our desire. And if you say, I don't yet have the desire, then pray to have the desire. Ask Krishna, you know, please give me the desire. Sometimes we're even afraid to do that. So then at least say, Krishna, give me the courage to ask for the desires. At least we can do that. At least we can say, Krishna, give me courage to do the right thing. So tomorrow we'll also be looking at a little bit of the heart, but there with more detail, and looking at the Sushumna. So questions, comments, corrections? Yes. Yeah. But it's all alive. You find the reflection of them in the material world. I'm sure they don't look the same. Yes, they look blue. The quality is completely different. I mean, even on the higher planets in this material universe, I'm sure the jewels don't look quite the same. I'm sure they're much more beautiful. Probably beyond anything that we can even imagine in this body. I mean, our ability to see in this body is very, very limited. When people have out-of-body experiences, they often say that their ability to see and hear becomes greatly enhanced. If you don't have the covering of... You know, usually we think, I see because of these eyes. But really, it's a covering. Prabhupada talks like that. He says it's like you put a glove on your hand. How much can you enjoy? Or, you know, in really cold places, you don't even get gloves. You get a mitten. You know what a mitten is? Where you have one section for these four fingers and another section for your thumb. It's usually this big, bulky thing. And sometimes it's even insulated. So it's like this thick. And what can you perceive through a mitten? Basically nothing. So when we have these gross earthly bodies, our ability to perceive things is practically, it's almost nil. We're hardly even able to perceive what's around us on this planet. There are subtle entities, favorable and unfavorable, that come to this. We can't see them. They're around us. Like Prabhupada would talk about, you know, the demigods coming to the kirtan. Most of us can't see them. We don't perceive them at all. Not only not see them, we don't have any sense of their being there, but they're around. And there's colors and sounds that we can't perceive. Our perception is so limited. It's as if we have, you know, special earplugs and goggles, and we only see a certain thing. So when people have more subtle bodies, they can perceive a much greater range of sense perception. Therefore, it says the sense enjoyment on the higher planets is thousands of times greater. And what to speak of in one's spiritual body. And what there is to perceive is nicer also. So, what there is to perceive is nicer, and one's ability to perceive is nicer. But yeah, they have the original form there. Lapis lazuli airplanes. And Prabhupada says those airplanes fly without fuel. They don't need to worry about, you know, an energy problem. The airplanes are, they can go anywhere. They can go anywhere, they don't need any fuel. And yet we're attached to staying here with, you know, Lufthansa or something. We don't want to leave, we're afraid. What would I do without my, you know, KLM and Lufthansa and British Air? And Krishna's saying, why don't you ride on a living lapis lazuli airplane? No! It might hurt getting there, you know. Madness. Give me the security lines. They don't have any security lines for their airplanes in the spiritual realm. They don't need to pay any taxes. They don't need to make sure there's money on their credit card to get on the airplane. No passport, no visa. No air pollution, noise pollution. You don't have to worry about them losing your luggage. And still we don't want to go. Oh, we're still attached. No, let me stay here. I prefer it. I prefer my material desires. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.